Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Funeral services for Tyre Nichols are expected to begin any moment now. The families of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor are there to support Tyre Nichols' family. On Saturday, January 7th, Tyre Nichols, a 29-year-old black man, was on his way home to his mom's after taking photographs of the sunset. He loved taking photographs. On his website, T. Nichols Photography, he wrote, quote, "My mission is to bring my viewers deep into what I am seeing through my eyes and out through my lens. I hope to one day let people see what I see and to hopefully admire my work based on the quality and ideals of my work. So on that note, enjoy my page and let me know what you think. Your friend, Tyre D. Nichols." On January 7th, Tyre Nichols was pulled over about 100 yards from his mom's house. Police say he was pulled over for driving recklessly, but Memphis Police Chief Sarah Lynn Davis said after looking at multiple cameras in the area, there was no proof of reckless driving. We are not going to play audio from the horrific footage so many of us have seen by now, but we are going to discuss the savage police beating and what it will take to move beyond the same conversations we have been having for years about police reform. Joining us today are two guests. Randolph McLaughlin is a civil rights attorney, counsel for the New York-based law firm Newman Ferreira LLP, and professor at Pace University School of Law, where he teaches courses on civil rights, litigation, labor law, voting rights, and civil procedure. Randolph McLaughlin began his legal career in 1978 at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he pioneered the development of legal strategies to redress racially motivated violence. In 1982, he won a $535,000 award for five black women who had been attacked by members of the Chattanooga Ku Klux Klan. And Randolph goes by Randy. Hi, Randy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
We're also joined by Austin McCoy, assistant professor of history at West Virginia University, where he focuses on African American history, the U.S. left, labor, the economy, social movements, and activism. Austin McCoy is writing a book on the history of the left in the Midwest and is a frequent contributor to Truthout. His latest piece is called "We Must Refuse Normal Life After Police Violence Like the Killing of Tyre Nichols." Hi, Austin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Austin, I want to start off with you. Thank you for writing this piece. I could relate to so much of it. You write that your stomach turned when you first watched the video. You thought about the impossibilities of carrying on with business as usual as you went to bed that night. You write, "I typed on my phone after waking up in the middle of the night. My world stops when these murders happen." So now that you've had a couple of days to process all of this and to read the news reports, what's going through your mind right now? I mean, we're talking as the funeral for Tyre Nichols is about to begin.
Right. I mean, what I would say first is, you know, like, I am exhausted, right? I mean, I think that's sort of how this process goes. You learn about these instances of police murders, and then you go through the sort of gamut of emotions. So, I mean, yeah, it's only been a few days, but I don't think I've fully processed, you know, what I watched on Friday. And it's hard to imagine watching a video like that and listening to the audio and being able to process it, right? And I think that's one of the points of the piece that I wrote. It's, you know, how many times are we going to go through this acting as if we can just, you know, keep it moving, so to speak. And I just don't think it's just impossible. It seems impossible to me. And it feels like it's growing tougher and tougher to do so after each instance of police officers murdering people.
Right. You know, I have to say, after I saw it, like you, I just couldn't sleep. And I just thought about all of the black and brown men who were going to get in their cars the next day and how that would feel. And yeah. My brother was visiting from out of town, a brown guy, pretty big guy. And I asked him last night, I said, "How do you feel driving back to dad's house?" He goes, "I'm scared." He said, "I'm glad I'm older now." He goes, "But I'm scared."
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, this is what happens, right? I mean, whether it is Tyree Nichols, you know, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, right? I mean, like all the conversations that, at least for me, all the conversations that my mom had with me about the police, all the instances that, you know, or incidents that I might have had with police officers, you know, all the times I've been pulled over, you know, all those things, they run through your mind, right? Mm-hmm. As you're watching these videos and as you begin to think, well, you know, let me make sure I don't forget my wallet. Like, I mean, that's the one, like for me, like forgetting my wallet is like one of my biggest fears, wow. You know, like, cause yeah, like, I'm like, well, my luck, I might get pulled over without a wallet. I don't know what could happen. Right. Mm. Yeah, like it's, you know, it's a reminder that all of this stuff is real for many of us. Right. And, you know, it just brings back bad memories, memories of conversations, you know, prior feelings that we, you know, that we've had and reactions and anger and everything. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's a totally valid response to be like, yeah, I'm afraid.
Right. Brandy, what about you? What was your reaction to the horrific video? And now that it's been a couple of days, what's going through your mind as this funeral is about to begin?
Me, it's just anger. I mean, it's just rage. I'm not tired. I'm not upset. I'm just enraged. And here's what enrages me. It's the myopia of the American people. What does he mean by that? We look at these horrific things. It's like we're in a crash site and we're driving by and everybody rubbernecks and looks at the crash. Then we drive on and we forget about it. We go back to our normal lives. That's what police violence is in this country. It's an epidemic for black men, brown men, indigenous men and women, and black men and women, and poor people generally. It's an epidemic of violence. And no matter how many times we have these stories, no matter how many lawsuits we have, it just keeps happening. Why? Because it's embedded in our culture. Some people in this country are still less than. And that's what the problem is. I suggest to you that if those five cops, black, white, or whatever color they could have been, had stopped a young white man in a suit and tie and doing the same things that Mr. Nichols is alleged to have done, he wouldn't have been treated that way. But they put him, as they do many of us, into a box. As Austin said, I'm older now, so I'm not as afraid. He's right. The older you get, the less fear others have of you. As a black person, I'm a black person. And I'm aware now in Manhattan, I can get a cab fairly easily. When I was 19, I couldn't. So youth, young black youth, are placed in a category of violent propensity individuals. These are violent prone people. They're criminals. They may have a weapon. They took him down as if he was a gang member, not someone who had merely driven off on the wrong side of the road. That kind of an activity doesn't warrant the response that he got. So and on any number of levels, I can go on for hours about this, about why I'm angry. But here's one thing I have to say. I've never heard any reporter ever describe any violence engaged in by white officers against black individuals as savage. Never. But when these black officers did it, now it's their savages. I reject that. They're not savages. They're police officers. They were trained to do this. They were trained that this was acceptable conduct by the department. This unit that they created was a unit that was designed to get guns and drugs off the street. And how did they do it? By violence. Now we're starting to hear that this isn't the first case where these officers have acted this way. Right. Only thing here, they took it too far. They got carried away. But look at the reaction they had after they beat this man senseless. They're sitting around joking like they went to a football game. Mm. It was like nothing had happened. And then what you also see is the lie. They started to create and manufacture a lie that they then wrote down on a police report. And but for the video, no one would have believed the story of Mr. Nichols. they would have said, well, he must have done something wrong. But with the video, we now see the truth. But watch the trial. The lawyers are going to say, you didn't see everything. There's stuff not in the video. It's outside the frame. So the video, don't believe your lying eyes. That's what they're going to tell the jury.
You know, to your point, Randy, the police report written just after the incident does not mention the brutal beating and instead claims Tyre Nichols, quote, started to fight with officers and reached for one of the guns. And then the other thing, and we have a clip from Tyre Nichols' mom, Rovan Wells, which we'll play in a few minutes. But she told CNN, and I wondered, I just happened to watch this long interview last night, why this isn't getting more attention. When the Memphis Police Department banged on her door that night, they told her Tyre Nichols had been arrested for a DUI.
This isn't surprising to me. We have a case of a young man who was killed, well, who died in police custody in Westchester County, right beside, outside of New York, a little ways outside. And same thing. Cops rolled up on the woman. Her son was dead. The cops rolled up on her house, knocked on the door. Hi, is this ex your son? Yes, well, he's been arrested. Does he have any health problems? They start asking her all sorts of questions without telling her son was dead. Mm. So that's what they do. When they killed Amadou Diallo, 42 bullets in Harlem, the cops immediately went into his apartment and ransacked it, trying to find something. They always want to justify their murderous actions. It's what was said in that great movie Training Day by Denzel Washington. It's not what you know, it's what you can prove.
Mm. Well, let's play a clip. This is Tyre Nichols' mom, Rovan Walls, telling CNN how she found out about Tyre's arrest.
The Memphis Police Department banged on our door approximately around between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, asking if I knew Tyre Nichols. And we said, yes, what's going on? He's been arrested. Arrested for what? DUI. DUI? My son don't drink like that. What do you mean, DUI? Well, we had to pepper spray him and tase him, so he's being attended to by the paramedics, and we'll send him to the hospital, and then after that, he'll go to booking. What? They then asked me, was he on any type of drugs or anything of that nature? Because they were saying that it was so difficult to put the handcuffs on him and he had this amount of energy, superhuman energy. And what they were describing was not my son. So I was very confused. I asked if I can go to the hospital. They told me no. They left. My husband and I, we got in our car and we went to go see if we could find Ty because he wasn't answering his phone or anything. When I asked them where my son was, they said nearby. Nearby? What is nearby? I got nothing from them. I think now that I'm actually putting things together, I believe they were trying to cover it up when they first came to my door.
That is Tyre Nichols' mom, Rovan Wells, telling CNN how she found out about what happened to her son. She then said she finally got a call from the hospital at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they said, why aren't you here? She said, the police told me I couldn't go to the hospital, and they didn't tell me where he was. Randy, what goes through your mind when you hear Rovan Wells talking about how she found out about all of this?
What's wrong with these people? I mean, seriously, when did they check their humanity at the door before they put on the blue uniform? It's unbelievable to me. Have they no sympathy, no empathy? The woman's son, you've beaten him to a pulp. He's going to die in a couple of days, and you're lying to her? you know, what as a lawyer, having sued a number of police officers and departments in these kinds of cases, I always wonder, you know, why can't you just tell the truth? If what you did is correct, tell the truth. Tell the truth. But you could hear the lie even on the videotapes that are being played. You hear the cop saying, get on the ground, get on the ground. He says, I'm on the ground. They say, give us your hands. He says, you've got my arm. What do you want me to do? I mean, it was the lie was manufactured right then and there. Right then and there, almost immediately. You know, listen, most Americans, most people can't lie that fast. You know, but they teach officers in the academy, it's called test-a-lying. That's what it's called. How to testify and lie and not get caught. Well, there's a new thing now. I call it video lying. Mm. We know the video's on, so we're going to say things that aren't true so that when it's played back later on, it'll justify what we're doing to this man. That's what this is now. Now we are now videographers, and we're going to lie to the cameras so that we can get out of whatever we're doing. The problem is there was a poll camera that they didn't control, and you could see them punching him so much his head is just bouncing from one side of the video to the other, like he's a human pinata.
Austin, that's what a lot of people are talking about, that these guys know that these body cams are on. I mean, we're living now in a country with cameras everywhere, and yet they know that. They still do it, and as Randy say, then they start to create their own narrative.
Yeah, I mean, we're at a point where I think we all just need to stop being surprised, right? I mean, like I think we with each of these incidents that just seem to get worse and worse, like there seems to be, or at least I detect from people reporting about this that, like, wow, we're just shocked at this. And it's just like, no, Randy explained it perfectly. It's like, this is what they do. You can tell, like, this is part of the, at the very least, informal training that they might go through, right? So, like, maybe in police academy, you don't learn how to do all this stuff, but they tell each other how to do all this stuff, right? So, yeah, like, Randy asked, right? Like, why couldn't you tell the truth? And he answered his own question, right? Can't tell the truth because you can't say that you actually beat someone on the edge of death and beat them to death on camera and to anyone else, because they're still going to try to cover their own. They're still going to try to cover their own. So, yeah, like body cameras, you know, it's something that when we were doing organizing work in Ann Arbor, because the police shot and killed a Black woman there in 2014, Aura Rosser, it's something that folks was calling for. But, you know, after, you know, the police instituted these, we also knew that this wasn't really going to stop people or stop police from killing people. The only way you're going to stop police from killing people is to basically get the police out of policing minor infractions. But then also, in my opinion, we need to find a way to, you know, transform how we think about public safety. You know, we need something that's not the police as it is right now.
That is Austin McCoy, assistant professor of history at West Virginia University. He's writing a book on the history of the left in the Midwest and is a frequent contributor to Truthout. His latest piece is We Must Refuse Normal Life After Police Violence Like the Killing of Tyre Nichols. Randolph McLaughlin is a civil rights attorney, counsel for the New York-based law firm Newman Ferrara, and professor at Pace University School of Law. In 1982, he won a $535,000 award for five Black women who'd been attacked by members of the Chattanooga Ku Klux Klan. If you'd like to join us to talk about your reaction to this video, I also, where should the conversation go from here? We've been doing series about this violence for so many years. We've brought on police officers with Black Lives Matter activists. We've had so many guests talk about these issues. What should the conversation, where does it go from here beyond the same conversations we keep having about police reform? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Now, I said we're not going to play video from the horrific audio from the video, but I will just talk about what happened for those who might not know. So Tyre Nichols' car was boxed in by two unmarked police vehicles. Another police officer then drives up. An officer violently drags Tyre Nichols out of the car, and three cops immediately begin screaming. On the ground, Nichols follows several orders saying, "I didn't do anything." After more violent commands with officers violating his body and standing over him, Tyre says, "You guys are really doing a lot right now. I'm just trying to get home." The cops become increasingly angry and begin threatening him with a taser. An officer then shoots pepper spray into his face, and he manages to flee on foot. So at this point, Randy, I mean, I don't want to go over every single thing because, again, this is not a unique case, obviously. But these police officers claim that they pulled him over for reckless driving. The chief of police said, "We looked at so much footage. There was no reckless driving. We do not have the footage of the seconds before he was pulled over. We basically have footage of an officer violently dragging him out of the car." We should mention that these officers are very young. They range in age from 24 to 32. So, I mean, what really strikes you about the beginning of what we saw, and how common is this kind of officers violently dragging people out of the car?
Well, I don't know of too many instances where you're stopped for how you're driving your car and you're beaten like this. It's a traffic stop. Ask me for my license, registration, give me a ticket, let me go on my way. That's it. It's very simple. But what happened here is, remember, who were these officers? They were the street crime officers. So when they saw him driving that vehicle, for whatever reasons, they perceived him as a gang member, as a violent criminal, and they treated him that way, despite the fact that he did nothing. This is a stereotypical attack. They stereotyped him, then they attacked him, because they thought that they did nothing wrong, that they were justified. As Austin said, when the videos came in, the body cams, the notion was it would decrease the number of violent incidents like this because the police would know that they're being videotaped. Well, it didn't stop it here. Not one whit, not one bit. But in terms of police reform, we need to do two things. We need to look at who we're hiring as police officers, and when they get on the job, when they act inappropriately, what do we do? Do we wait a year or 2 years before they're indicted? Do we wait a year like they did in Chicago before they released the tapes, not to upset the community? Listen, what Memphis did, at least in this instance, is a textbook case. Incident occurred, videotape was observed, they fired these officers almost immediately, they charged them with very high crime, second-degree murder, and they released the videotapes so we can all see what's happened. And look at the reaction in Memphis. The reaction in Memphis isn't like what we had in Minneapolis with George Floyd. Not at all. Very different. Why? Because of the way the system responded. And if that happens in the future, we may not have those kind of violent incidents. But let's go back to police hiring. There are two types of officers that you can hire, that police kind of work. One, they're called warrior cops, the SWAT team, ESU, Emergency Services Unit. These are the guys who go out when there's a violent episode. They come out in military gear, and they do battle. That's what they're there for, and they're needed for that in those situations. But the other kind of cops are the cops you call when your car is locked and you need help, or your parent died in the house and you call for help. These are the ones who come not to beat you up. They come to render aid and assistance. So we need to figure out and find a way to determine in the hiring process which kind of officer is this person? Which kind of person is he? We need to develop mechanisms, tests, simulations to ascertain, does this person have a propensity for violence to solve their problems? I'll give you a totally different example, but it's relevant to this in this sense. Let me do it. So years ago, my wife and I were part of a program that trained service animals, service dogs. And one of the things we had to determine and help the program to determine whether or not this dog, this young dog, had a strong prey instinct. What's a prey instinct? It's the instinct dogs have, humans too, to chase squirrels, chase prey. That's how we survived. It's bred into our DNA. So when we watched these dogs, the dog I had, squirrel would walk right in front of the dog, dog wouldn't blink. Other dog, squirrel walks, he's chasing the squirrel. We need to develop programs and programmatic analyses and testing methods to determine whether that officer, that potential officer, has a strong prey instinct, because that person is going to be prone to violence, because that's what predators do. They catch, they beat, they kill. That's what predators do. We're predators, and we have to acknowledge that's who we are. So your instincts can take over your training, and that's what we need to find out. But we don't. We just don't. We have a psychological test. We have, you know, the bare minimum. But if you test them going in, you can weed out those violent prone individuals, just like we need to weed out the racist individuals who want to be police officers for all the wrong reasons.
How common is it for officers this young, 24 to 32, to work for a unit like this, where they're out after dark in unmarked police cars?
Well, that's another problem, I think, that these were really inexperienced cops. Right? They were young, they were inexperienced. I'm not sure how well they were trained. But one of the problems is the specialized nature of the unit. A specialized unit like that, where the officers know they're going to have to engage in acts of violence because they're dealing with violent-prone criminals. That's what their perception is. So that's going to attract a certain kind of officer who wants to engage and has no problem engaging in physical acts of violence. So you've got to find out, is this someone who engages in acts of violence to calm themselves, to solve their emotional drama or traumas, or is that a person who uses violence only as necessary? So you're really asking officers to act against their human instincts, their human instincts. We only have two instincts, fight or flight. There's no instinct that says negotiate, de-escalate. That's not instinctual. Our instincts, our DNA tells us if a threat appears, we kill it or we run away from it. Those are the only options we have. So Mr. Nichols, he was acting just as he should have. He clearly perceived a threat, and he ran away. The others, the officers who chased him, they perceived a threat, and they wanted to fight him. Mm-hmm. That's what was going on. It was instinctual behavior.
Right, and what we can conclude from the video is when he manages to flee on foot. I mean, these officers were already being so violent with him, but it was clear that they at that point became enraged. A white officer who initially drew his gun and then put that away to grab his taser was then suspended after the five black cops were fired. And when Tyre Nichols ran away, that white officer said, "I hope they stomp his ASS." And that was right when he ran away from the car, and then they caught up with him a block later. We're going to take a quick break. That is Randolph McLaughlin, a civil rights attorney and professor at Pace University School of Law, where he teaches courses on civil rights, litigation, and labor law. Austin McCoy is assistant professor of history at West Virginia University. He wrote a piece for Truthout called "We Must Refuse Normal Life After Police Violence, Like the Killing of Tyre Nichols." This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue discussing the brutal beating of Tyre Nichols and where this conversation needs to go from here. Before the break, we were just talking about what happened when he managed to flee on foot. He was apprehended a block away, and the footage that we see from a body cam and a light pole shows just a horrific beating. It lasts for 3 minutes. He was handcuffed, and then he was repeatedly kicked in the head, punched in the face, hit with a baton, pepper sprayed. At one point, the officers actually hold up his limp body and they take turns punching him. The New York Times reports that officers gave 71 commands that were confusing, conflicting, and just impossible to obey. When he was handcuffed, the officers yelled, "Give us your hands," as they beat him with a baton. And in the video, we hear Tyre screaming for his mom, who was just 100 yards away. He screamed for his mom three times. Today, we're joined by Randolph McLaughlin, a civil rights attorney, professor at Pace University School of Law. Austin McCoy is assistant professor of history at West Virginia University. He wrote a piece for Truth Out called "We Must Refuse Normal Life After Police Violence Like the Killing of Tyre Nichols." Austin, I think you mentioned that these cops obviously have a history. The Commercial Appeal in Memphis had a piece just yesterday called "Four Officers Indicted in Tyre Nichols' Death Had Previous Reprimands and Suspensions by the Memphis PD." And now people in the community are bravely stepping forward to tell TV stations about the interactions the horrific interactions they had with these cops. And yet here they are, still in this unit in an unmarked car after dark.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, like, this isn't funny, but like, it's just like, I don't know, when I hear a question or a statement and it's just like, well, like, this keeps happening. And right. It's like, yes, it's going to keep happening, right? Like, it's going to keep happening because, one, we live in a society that's governed, basically by the thin blue line. Like, many Americans believe in this idea that the police exist to protect the rest of us, quote unquote, or at least some of us, from the rabble, from the folks who are perceived as threats, right? I mean, so this idea that I would like to believe that we could live in a country where the police could be an institution that actually serves and protects. I just don't believe that. And so what's going to happen is you have all these Black folks who have these interactions with police. And I've gone through this too, where it's like you talk to people about it, just regular people, not even just going to the police station. You're talking to regular folks who you think are your friends, and they don't believe you. And they ask or they insinuate, well, what did you do wrong? Mm. Right? So what happens is all these folks just keep the stories among themselves, and they create their own survival mechanisms with dealing with the police, right? And sometimes these mechanisms obviously don't matter. Right. Because this is what happened to Tyre Nichols. His mom, folks, hey, you see the police, you do everything that they tell you to do. You know, if you need to negotiate, you negotiate, but just do whatever they tell you to do. You should be fine. And that's what Tyre did. This, you know, coming back to what Randy was talking about fight or flight. Right. Tyre Nichols was the only person in the whole situation who was acting rational. And he started by negotiating, right? He started by trying to comply. And once he realized this is not going to work, I'm going to go run. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go run home, right? So he was trying to run home. So people keep on talking about how he was screaming for his mother. That is true, but this is different from George Floyd in the sense of George Floyd is screaming from his mother because solely he knew he could die. He was going to die. Tyre Nichols was hoping that his mom would hear him so that she might actually be able to intervene, right? So on the one hand, yes, Tyre Nichols understood that his life was in danger, but also this was a very, like, he's less than 100 yards away. He's screaming, not out of the sort of primordial, you know, fear or instinct for his mother. It's, my mom is actually down the street, right? So, you know, I mean, I think, again, like, in this is why having these conversations, you know, I think they're important, but it's also like, no, we're going to keep on being here unless we sort of, on the one hand, you know, at the very least start to have these conversations and allow Black folks and other victims of police violence to tell their stories. And we believe them. We don't just interrogate them. Right. So then what happens is when we interrogate them, they're just going to go back into their shell anyway, develop their own survival mechanisms. But then we also have to think pretty radically about how we want public safety to look like in this country. Because even if we're going to screen out all the violent folks all the folks that we think might be violent, the institution is violent in itself, right? Mm. The institution policing in itself is violent. So you're going to have police are still going to be killing people when they shouldn't be killing people. It doesn't matter if they used to be football players. It doesn't matter if they're younger. It doesn't matter if they're bigger like that. Because if you think about what happened with Tyre Nichols, they shouldn't have been pulling him over in the first place.
Right.
Right. They weren't traffic police.
Right.
So if they go to his mother and say, well, we pulled him over for a DUI, none of that is consistent. So what do we do with folks where it's like we want to create these categories of policing and they're still going to cross those boundaries anyway because they know that they can do that and get away with it.
We're going to take calls in just a minute. Thank you for waiting patiently. I just want to ask you, Austin, and then Randy. I feel in some cases these questions are just blah. Like, what do we ask at this point? Yes, we want to talk about the details. We want to, respect the family and elevate their voices. But where do you want the conversation to go from here, Austin?
I want the conversation. If there's going to be a conversation, we got to have a good faith conversation. To be completely honest, like when folks started talking about we're sort of on the precipice of a reckoning in 2020. That sounded nice, but I wasn't entirely optimistic. And one of the reasons why I'm not entirely optimistic is we still live in a country where there's a lot of Americans who deny that structural racism exists. Mm-hmm. And anytime folks want to talk about racism, again, they get questioned or it's going to be denied let's not even teach the history of this. Right. So it's like we have to have the conditions. Like if we want to have an actual conversation where we can move somewhere in terms of actually fixing the problem of violence, of state violence in this country, we have to have the conditions have to be present. And part of those conditions means we have to be able to have good faith conversations and not be having conversations with folks who their sole purpose in the conversation is to try to undermine Black folks and other people of color who are talking about their actual experiences.
What about you, Randy? Where do you want this conversation to go?
I'll be frank with you. I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want any more conversations. I want action. I want folks to do something. That's what I want. I'll give you an example. So when the Roe v. Wade got struck down by the Supreme Court, all of a sudden across the country, women and others start to get active in their states with the state constitutions, etc. We should take a page from their book. If the Supreme Court is not our friend anymore, and it was only our friend for a very short period of time in its history, remember Dred Scott and Plessy v. Ferguson? Supreme Court's been an enemy of Black folks since its founding. We need to turn to the states. We need to do the same thing. We need to get state constitutions amended to prevent this kind of violence, to prevent this kind of racist policing. We need to get state district attorneys to say, if this happens in our community, we're going to prosecute you. Make that clear to these people. Because once it starts to happen enough, not like getting struck by lightning, once cops know I beat this guy up, I may go to jail, guess what they're going to stop doing? Beating people up. That's the only way. You make people pay for what they've done. So we've got to get active at the local level, in the legislatures, in the district attorney's office, because as far as I can tell, at the federal, national level, with the Congress that we now have, with the MAGAs running the House, you've got no chance of getting police reform through those idiots. Right. The only way we're going to have this happen now, we can't depend on the Supreme Court. Forget about that. They're run by right-wing conservatives, religious zealots, and we have a political structure that's broken. Broken. So we have to go to the states. We have to, and lawyers all across the country have to stop sitting in their fancy offices making gazillions of dollars representing corporations and spend a little time representing the people. Representing the people. And taking these cases, make them pay, punish them, they'll be changed their behavior. It'll take time. It took 30 years before the segregation rule from Plessy v. Ferguson was overturned in Brown. It's taken us another, you count the years from 54 to now, X number of years to still try and build a better American society. And we're a little closer, but not that. We have to have a long-term effort. You can't just wake up, I'm woke, and then go back to sleep. And you can't depend on your allies to stay woke. We have to remain active, engaged, and conscious of what our objective is.
So I'm so glad you brought this up, because the body cams are not working. Having cameras all over the place is not working. I mean, it was devastating to watch Rodney King's daughter, Laura Danae King, who was with a group of people watching this horrific video. And she said it was worse than her father's. She also said it seems there's been no change except for clearer videos, because back then somebody had a video cam that took that video. So do you think, Randy, that if we see more and more officers charged, things will change? And after you answer that, can you just tell us how unusual this was, that a grand jury returned indictments against the five officers for crimes, including second degree murder? And this happened so quick, much quicker than all the past police brutality and police killings.
Let me tell you, this is highly irregular. I've been doing this for over 40 years. I've never seen a police officer or a group of them indicted as quickly as these officers were indicted. I mean, we've represented the families of individuals who've been killed by the police, and at least two instances now. We've worked so hard with district attorneys, gotten their officers indicted, and they're in jail. One went to jail for 20 years for murdering a black man here in New York State. Another one's been, he shot, almost killed someone. He's in jail for 7 to 8 years. So it can be done, but it takes a lot of political will, it takes a lot of energy, and it takes a commitment. My partner and I have been involved in a police killing case. Just so you know, it's a film called The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain Sr. It's on Netflix. We've been involved in that case for almost 12 years now. 12 years. No indictments. They killed this man in his home after they broke into his apartment. No indictments. But we're still pursuing justice for this family. That's the kind of commitment we need as activists, as attorneys, as journalists. Don't turn away just because the spotlight has been turned off. Keep your eyes. Keep your eyes on the prize, because if you don't, we'll be having this conversation until I'm long gone. Mm.
Well, just yesterday, Oakland Side reported that District Attorney Pamela Price is going to reopen 8 police killings for possible criminal prosecution. The new DA has asked for case files from various police agencies, including 2 Oakland police shootings from over a decade ago. We are almost out of time, but we have a few listeners who've been waiting patiently. So let's take a few calls and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Monica in Fremont. Hi, Monica. Thanks for holding. Monica, are you still with us? All right. Sorry we lost you. Let's go to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary.
Yes, thank you. He shouldn't have been pulled over in the first place. Right. I'd like to bring a book into the conversation, which we're way past. I want to know if your guests are familiar with the book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. The author is James Forman, Jr., and it's a meticulously researched, he's a scholar in criminal justice, and it's a troubling tendency of Black and Latinx prosecutors and judges to judge more harshly with Black and Latinx defendants, especially in drug charges. And the fact that these Black police officers were so excessive. What he does is go, Dr. Forman goes back and socioeconomic, even faith-based reasons for why this might be so. So I want to find out if they're familiar with the book. And as far as national policy goes, at this point, I hear the words drug and substance. Can somebody say the word marijuana out loud? Because federal prohibition is a license to lynch. There's that young Black man with an air freshener. We know what that means. Prohibition puts us all in a chokehold. So can we look at policy on a national level? Because policing is only as good as policy. And we can abolish all we want. But I think we have to really focus on this part of it. So thank
thank you for the call. We actually are reaching out to James Forman to join the show, and hopefully he can join us soon. Austin, are you familiar with his work?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the book. I would say, honestly, it's been a long time since I've picked it up. I understand the argument in terms of, Black folks, participating in the expansion of mass incarceration, whether it is, by, being prosecutors or, even in this case, right, Black police officers, beating Tyre Nichols. And it sort of goes to this question that's being asked, as if, Black folks haven't really understood this, right? It's like, well, how can a group of Black folks participate in such a system and participate in such a beating like this? And it, I just always sort of come back to NWA with Ice Cube saying black police showing out for the white cop, right? I mean, like, there is a long history of Black folks serving in authority, in positions of authority, going back to even slavery, serving as, being forced to be overseers, right? And sort of participating in, this system, in that system. So for me, it's something that, again, I think this case is sort of forcing more Americans to have a conversation. And I think more Americans are understanding and realizing that Black folks have been having this conversation for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a situation where it's like, okay, like, this is part of structural racism. It doesn't matter what color you are. If you participate in the system, you will probably also be participating in, committing acts of state violence against folks who look like you.
Randy, what would you add?
I've read the book. I'm familiar with the book. Dr. Forman came to the law school where I teach at Pace and lectured about his topics, and I found it fascinating. And he's the son of a core activist whose name was James Forman, who led the civil rights movement partly in the South with the Freedom Riders. So it's very interesting to me that the fruit doesn't drop too far from the tree, and I like that. I think it's helpful to have the analysis as to, why these officers, these Black officers, would act this way. But, here's the bottom line for me. Once you put on that blue uniform, you don't bleed Black, you bleed blue. That's what you bleed. And so you're now part of this club. And whether there was, and there was a white officer there, I'm not sure they were acting out to so they could, curry favor with him. I think that they knew this was something they could do and there'd be no consequence. What someone said, one of the police experts I saw on one of these cases said, if you run from us, we're going to punish you. We're going to show you what happens. And that's what this was. They were trying to show him what's going to happen if you do this. The problem is it went too far. It wasn't one or two officers punching the guy and he might have survived. It was five. And these were big, burly men. He's a small, little, skinny guy. They're beating him senseless. They felt they could get away with it. I dare say, as you alluded to, this is not the first time they've engaged in this kind of behavior. Nothing was done before. This time, they went too far. And if you don't stop a little bit of bad behavior, it doesn't get better. It gets worse.
To your point, Tyre Nichols was 6'3 and weighed just 150 pounds, and these were big guys. It's just... It's horrific. The other thing, just watching the video, Randy, you just have to wonder, when one guy starts in, others follow. I mean, some people say, why can't someone come jump in and say, okay, enough already. We need to stop this. I mean, is there some sort of pack mentality that happens here?
Yes, it's a cop mentality. What turns good cops into bad cops are bad cops. That's what happens. So when you see this, because I've represented officers who made complaints with internal affairs, and they were treated like pariahs. They were treated like rats, and they were not protected by their other fellow officers and could have been killed in those situations. So officers seeing bad behavior, they keep their mouths shut. I'll give you a classic example. Many, many years ago in Brooklyn, there was a man named Abner Louima. And he was arrested and placed into a precinct in a bathroom and raped with a broom handle up his rectum, screaming. No one in the precinct came to his aid. They couldn't help but hear it. He's screaming. The cop who did it went to jail. He got arrested and convicted. Yes, he should have. But no one helped him. No one came to his aid. No one wanted to be seen as the rat. You're not part of the team. Shut your mouth. Go along to get along. That's the name of the game. Until you break that culture, this problem is never going to go away.
You know, just in our remaining minute, in terms of how the process works, the police chief said that she heard about this at 4 a.m, went to the office, saw the video, immediately knew that something was obviously wasn't right. It was, she said she's never seen anything like this. And so things moved quickly. What is it going to take for that to happen in other departments?
You're going to need first political will. You're going to need officers and executives, I mean, police executives who are willing to do what that Memphis police chief did. I don't see that happening in too many places. Honest to God, I'm hoping this, quote, conversation starts to move the needle a little bit, but I'm not too optimistic. I think this will continue until it doesn't, until we're no longer looking at the accident. We're looking at something else, some other shiny little object. Until the next time, and we'll start these conversations all over again. It's a Greek mythology myth called the myth of Sisyphus. He was sentenced to constantly push a rock up the hill and it would roll back down. And he could never get it over the hill. That's what we are. We're Sisyphus. We're just pushing this rock up the hill and it keeps rolling back on us.
Randolph McLaughlin is a civil rights attorney, professor at Pace University School of Law. He has been fighting for justice for Kenneth Chamberlain. You can see the film The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain Sr. on Netflix. Randy, thanks for keeping it real. We'd love to have you back.
Anytime.
Austin McCoy is assistant professor of history at West Virginia University. His Truth Out piece is called We Must Refuse Normal Life After Police Violence Like the Killing of Tyre Nichols. Austin, thank you so much for your work. Thanks for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. We'll continue part 2 of this discussion on tomorrow's show. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.